This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out. Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in Biblical Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Jonathan Lukadu, the host of the channel. Today, we'll be talking to Marcus Vincent about his new book, Resetting the Origins of Christianity, A New Theory of Sources and Beginnings. Marcus, welcome to the show.
Well, thanks very much for inviting me, Jonathan.
Yeah. Oh, thank you for being here. I wonder if I could ask you just to tell us a little bit about yourself.
Oh, pleasure. Yeah. So I've been a professor for the history of theology and most particularly for patristic studies at King's College in London for about 12 years. From 2010 to 2022. And then I had the pleasure to take early retirement from this post while I'm still a guest professor at the University of Erfurt, where I've been part of the Max Weber Center for Cultural Studies for the last, 12, 13 years, and which I continue to do. In addition, I've been in the UK before, so I was Professor H.G. Wood Professor at Birmingham University. And before that, I had a post at the University of Cologne, because as you can hear from my dialect, I'm a German-speaking scholar, but who has lived more than half of my life in the UK. So before that, before Cologne, I've been to Cambridge, where I was also at King's College, and that wraps up a bit my career.
Oh,
but you better ask.
Oh, that's fantastic. No, that's really wonderful. And there's so much good work coming out of Erfurt these days. So
that's right.
Oh, that's fantastic.
Well, I have to say, I mean, I'm so much inspired by the Max Weber Kolleg, which is an interdisciplinary institute of postgraduate students and scholars from around the world. And there is a focus on religious studies, but in the broader sense. So we have anthropologists, ethnographers, we have sociologists, and that makes, of course, a heavy input into the questions of methodology, which we will be talking later.
It does. Yeah, that's right. Well, your book, yeah, Resetting the Origins of Christianity is very much an interdisciplinary book. I wonder if I can ask, how did you come to write this book?
That's a very nice question, because it was the offspring of an earlier book, which I published in 2019 with Cambridge University Press. And that is called The Writing of Early Christian History. So in this book, in the Cambridge book, I had a first chapter, which was a chapter on methodology, because the subtitle to this monograph is From Reception to Retrospection. And in this first chapter, I developed a new theory how to approach when we start writing history. When we write history, we write it in a chronological way. So we start with A and end with Z, which means if we write a history of early Christianity, we start with around the year zero, and then we end whenever we want to end, right? Like Schneller, who has published the first 100 years of early Christian history, he starts with zero and he ends up in the year 100. So we usually jump into history and then grow older with our protagonists. So we start with Jesus, we come to Paul, we come to the apostles, and then to the students of the apostles, and then after 100 years, yeah, we wrap up and say, well, that's the New Testament era or period. And then we come to a second period, which is the patristics period, starting with the apostolic fathers and then moving on. And when I was reflecting on this type of methodology for this 2019 book, it occurred to me that it is quite strange because we as historians, like you, Jonathan, myself, right, when we look back into, let's say, Ignatius or into the first century, we make a big loop and a big jump from 2021 back into, let's say, the second century. And we are, in fact, moving backwards and not forwards. And then it occurred to me that it's another strange phenomenon that as we speak now, you to me, me to you, we can only speak into the future. So all we can do is writing in a chronological way. And yet we think against the time clock. So we think backwards while we have to write forwards. So there's no chance. I mean, we are hardwired. Maybe a film can be rolled backwards, but we cannot think backwards. All we can do is think forwards and we can write forward. And I was wondering whether that has some impact when we think about how we reflect upon history. When we are serious by saying, well, I cannot think backwards in the way I write, while language is always the grammar of thinking. So there is distortion between the grammar of writing and speaking and the grammar of thinking. So that was the principal paradox I was thinking about in this first chapter. And by reflecting then, what does it mean if I take it serious that the thinking backwards is at the same time a chronological thinking forward? It occurred to me that when we take the movement backwards, we cannot have it as a continuous movement. All we can do is we can choose sections, like let's take Ignatius. We can take that section. And as soon as we reflect about that particular section, we have to give a chronological explanation. So while we think writing history is a continuous process, as we almost emulate when we say we write from the year zero to the year 100, as if we have a continuity, when we reflect backwards, it is anything but continuous. It's always a choosing of sections. And within those sections, we then establish a pseudo continuity. So that was the rough framework. And in this book for Cambridge, I just had chosen four snapshots, four particularly interesting areas of early Christian studies where I tried to approach these areas and the questions which were raised, not and no longer from a continuous chronological way of explanation, but I've chosen to go backwards in history and to reflect about the 21st century and the discourse we have on these topics. I then always asked, how did we come to those solutions? So I've chosen to slice the history by those sections where the new consensus was created. And so I've chosen slice by slice, like an archaeologist who traces back when he digs out the findings in the ground. So I sliced from today backwards a few sections where always a new kind of discourse had been established. So I did this in four sections, in four snapshots. And I thought at the time, because people asked me, well, how would it be with early Christian history per se, and not just a few snapshots of it? And that's why I sat down and thought, okay, I'll try. What was the time when more or less the chronological history of early Christianity had been created? And it occurred to me, I could have chosen the 19th century or the 18th, times of the Reformation, But the ground that has been laid for our impression how Christianity came about was in the medieval period. And that's why resetting the history of early Christianity, first of all, is a comprehensive attempt by writing history of early Christianity backwards rather than forwards. So the slicing of that history, and I've chosen to slice this history by taking the most important people, at least for the Western writing of early Christian history, the most important people who have created a kind of a lasting discourse through which we are informed how to understand how Christianity came about. And that's the book.
Oh, that's a fantastic description. And it shows really well the connections between resetting the origins of Christianity and your earlier 2019 book. That comes out really nicely. I wonder, thinking more about resetting the origins of Christianity, early in this book, you discuss Gregory of Tours and Orosius. And you mentioned that both men identify Christianity and Romanitas, so that Christianity and Romanness become identical. Can you say more about that? How did Gregory and Orosius identify Christianity and Romanness, and what effects did this have on their histories?
Yeah, let me answer that question. I could answer that question in two ways. I could answer it from a normal historical perspective. So I could jump into Gregory and into Orosius and answer your question. But if I do it from a retrospective perspective, then I would need to ask myself, why did I choose to look at this mingling of Gregory and of Orosius with their context? And I did this because I think one of the fundamental experiences and also thinking in the Western world today, and I always start with our contemporary discourse, is that we merge the so-called Western world, so our context, with Christianity. Now you're asking your questions not from a Western perspective, because you are sitting at a desk in Seoul in Asia. And yet, perhaps Korea is one of the countries that is most Westernized in the sense against the comparative countries in your surroundings. And nevertheless, it is Asia and not Western Europe. And I think it is so important to dislocate Christianity from this close connection between a political context and a cultural context. And the impression that we always give is that Christianity is a product of the Western world and only works in the Western world. Now, I've been so often and so long in Korea to know that Christianity works partly better in a non-Western environment and in a non-Western world than it does in some Western worlds. Hence, my question, already when I'm looking backwards into Gregory of Tours or into Orosius, is informed by the questions which are concerning myself today. Now, knowing that, of course, that might distort the historian's view and already the historian's question when looking into these authors, which means I'm not trying to shy away from then asking these questions, but I know right from the start, and I'm trying to be transparent with it, that when I'm asking these questions, when I'm looking into these works by Gregory and Orosius, I'm importing these types of questions which are relevant today. And that's also why I'm asking these questions when looking into these works. And by having done that, it occurred to me indeed that there is such a close connection between how Gregory writes his history of early Christianity and then also Orosius. But we might stick for a moment with Gregory. In Gregory, it's quite clear. His long 10 books of the history that he writes is almost entirely a history of the Franks. It's a history of his environment. And yet it is a history which he thinks is the history of Christianity. So when he writes about the early times, it is utterly vital to him that Lyon, the capital, was created as a city right when Jesus was alive. Now, one might ask now the question of Orosius, because he asked the same question. He said, well, why did Jesus live and why was he even born outside Rome? Hardly understandable. I mean, how is it possible that the savior of this world, right, is being born in the province of Rome and not in the capital? I mean, all emperors are part of the capital and capitalize on it, right? Although we know emperors rarely were born in Rome either. So, but that concerned Orosius and it concerned Gregory. So what is the connection between the divine and almost the divine empire? And we can see the struggle that Orosius has and also Gregory. Now, Orosius has a specific answer. I mean, probably quite a ridiculous one for us today. But he says, well, he needs to become a citizen of Rome. And you become a citizen of Rome by being enrolled in the tax roll. So and because there was a tax assessment in the province, that's why he needed to be born in the province rather than the capital. What sounds not probably convincing to us was apparently a type of explanation for the people at the time. But the baseline of that is, and that is a very modern question, how much Romanitas, so how much context feeds into a religious praxis? And from both authors, it becomes quite clear that the way they shape the history, their history of early Christianity, is the way they want to explain to the people, to themselves and to their readers and listeners, that Christianity is part and parcel, is densely connected with their political and cultural environment. So that's what I try to describe.
Yeah. Oh, thank you. Yeah, that's fantastic to really to set that question and that answer in context, in the context of both current historians and also these late antique medieval historians. Speaking of political context as well, you argue that Eusebius's church history has played maybe even a greater role than Gregory and Orosius in the formation of later histories of Christian origins. How did Eusebius tell the story of Christian origins, and how has that story continued to be influential in modern scholarship?
I think probably Eusebius is, if we want to sketch the entire history of the writing of early Christian history, Eusebius is the peak. He is the most important, most influential writer for our guild. I think more than 90% of what's left to us on early Christian writings, which are lost, are only preserved through the mentioning or the quoting of these words by Eusebius. And also the way he tries to portray these lost writings. And everything and everybody who writes about early Christianity can't circumvent Eusebius. He is the lens through which we have to look into the third, second, and the first century. Now, what I discovered, and also what is a second pillar of this book, is not just the question writing backwards and thinking backwards. The second pillar is also the question, what are the sources? What are the reference points of each of these layers? So when we look into the medieval period, what are the pillars on which these foundations that are being erected in the 10th century or in the 7th century are resting on? And it's quite clear, Gregory and Orosius that we mentioned, they both say that one of the most informative people for them and for their writing of the history has been and is Eusebius of Caesarea. So here we come into the first third of the fourth century. It is also the breaking up of the non-Christian past, and Eusebius tries to stylize the Roman Empire now as the cradle of Christianity. It is the utmost context where he sees that Christianity has achieved its mission, at least partways. So Eusebius is the reference point. He creates a new discourse, a discourse about the beginnings of early Christianity. And I then also asked, on which pillars is Eusebius relying? So what are his sources? And it's quite amazing that he does not make much use of the so-called canonical works. So he's almost not interested in, let's say, the Book of Acts, when he writes about the early history of the church. He's almost disinterested in the canonical Gospels, when he writes about Christ, which is also quite an interesting phenomenon. So who are the pillars, and what are the pillars for Eusebius' construction of early Christian history? That's one of the questions I'm asking in this book. And it turns out he has predominantly two sources from which he tries to draw his history of early Christianity. Two, let's say maybe even three. One source are Jewish authors. So it is Josephus and, to a lesser extent, Philo. A second source that he draws on is a letter exchange between Jesus and Abgar. Now, this is quite an interesting source because he claims himself to have discovered this type of evidence. And I use the word evidence for purpose because he displays it as if this is a fact which has come to him, which has shown itself to him. So he discovered it, he says, and then he translated it from Syriac into Greek. Now, interestingly, today, nobody takes serious that this letter exchange between Abgar and Jesus is authentic. And most people think even that it was a pseudonymous writing and maybe even a fictitious writing, probably produced by Eusebius himself. So out of the three sources, canonical writings, the Jewish writings, and the Abgar letter exchange with Jesus, the two most obscure ones for us today are his main sources. And that shows if he creates and reconstructs history, first of all, by relying, when he talks about Jesus and his mission and about the apostles' mission, based on a product that he had potentially created himself, it tells us a lot about the way he approaches history. And if he then adds what he draws from Josephus, the next question which I'm asking is, what is then the nature of the canonical writings? And interestingly, when we look into his books on church history, he deals with the canonical writings pretty late in his work. It comes about in book 3 and not in book 1. So usually he talks about the writings, relying them and relating them to the empress that are governing Rome. And so when in book 3 he's talking about the gospel literature, he's deep into Hadrianic times, which, as far as I've seen, nobody has discovered and nobody has even thought about, that it might even indicate the times of origin of these writings. Because usually he talks about whatever work it is, Clement or take a later one, he talks about these people related to the empress who reigned at the time. And so when he talks about the biblical writings, he doesn't relate them to Nero. It's not in the times of Nero when he talks about the biblical books, the canonical New Testament books. He talks about these New Testament writings in the middle of the second century. That's where he places them. Even if he then claims that these are apostolic writings which have been written in the first century. And so one has to reflect upon the construction that Eusebius does, the interpretation he gives, why we also have to relate it to the structure which he places in front of us. And that's quite an interesting one people haven't thought about. So Eusebius, for me, is a reconstructor of early Christian history. predominantly relying on himself and on Jewish writings. And then he tries also at the same time to make somehow a case for these canonical writings, which are still in his times, I think, not yet canonical. So he tries to figure out which of these writings he can see as reliable, as canonical, as writings which are being used by other people. Yet he himself makes very little use of it, which conflicts with his message. So that's the chapter on Eusebius.
That is a really fascinating conflict or paradox about Eusebius that I know I hadn't noticed before. So I was happy to see you bring that out and to be able to learn from you in that regard. I wonder, there's so many other sources that we could think through, Julius Africanus and the Acts of the Apostles. But I wonder, since you mentioned Hadrian and the canonical writings. In an appendix to the book, you kind of lay out what you think can be known of early Christianity in the first century or so of the Christian movement, say from 30 to 130 or thereabouts. I'll let you redefine that time period if I've got that wrong. But I wonder, how would you describe that first century of Christian origins for maybe readers who come to the book and are interested in finding out about that first century? What can we actually know of that time period?
When I wrote this book, probably I knew a bit less than I would know today. But I suggested in this book that the first 100 years appear to me, just following up with what we were saying about Eusebius, appears to me to be like a black box. The authors, later authors, have put into this black box what they wish to see in this black box. Yeah, and just like Eusebius, who probably creates his own fictitious source and evidence, from which he then draws to fill this black box. It is like another of the other authors we have, including Tertullian, including Irenaeus, and maybe even Justin and others, who have apparently very little knowledge about this first century, almost no knowledge at all. I mean, they probably knew as much as Suetonius and of Josephus. And that's why Josephus becomes the core of the Jewish writings for Eusebius. That's where he draws his information from, rather than from the canonical writings, which might be still a reflection that they didn't have much more than what they found in Josephus. And we know Josephus is a difficult case because Josephus is only being transmitted through Christians. It doesn't mean that I claim that Josephus didn't exist or that what he writes about Christians is all later fiction or interpolation. But we know, for example, when we compare the information Origen has about Josephus, that's very different from how Eusebius reads Josephus. For example, Origen doesn't know, and he says it explicitly, that what he reads in Josephus, he says, Josephus does not equate Jesus with a Messiah. And yet, that is exactly what we have in the Testamentum Flavianum. So either Josephus, Origen gives us the wrong information, or we must have had some different text in Josephus. So first of all, I think still when I was writing the book, it's pretty much a black box into which we fill too quickly from our canonical writings to have the content that even Eusebius didn't use as content, which makes and made me at the time reluctant in using the canonical material for writing the first 100 years as Schnelle and a thousand of other people do it. And having then worked on the canonical writings, I have seen, and I've long proposed, I mean, it was almost 15 years ago, that I invited Matthias Klinghardt to the Oxford Patristics Conference. It was when I published my first book on Christ's resurrection in early Christianity, where right at the end of publishing this book, I added a subtitle and the making of the New Testament. Because still when I was writing this book, I was under the impression, what I had learned myself, that the canonical writings preceded the collection of Marcion's New Testament. And yet, the more I reflected about the material, the less that made sense. And so I invited Matthias Klinghardt and a few other scholars to the Patristics Conference in 2010, if I remember rightly, or 11, and suggested, what about if Marcion's New Testament preempted the canonical New Testament? Now, Matthias, who had written an article in 2008 where he placed Marcion's gospel earlier than Luke, he was adamant that these texts, the canonical texts, were earlier than the Marcionite version of the text, except for the gospel where he thought Luke was later. But he was adamant that Mark was earlier than this gospel by Marcion. 5 years later, that he has worked on the material, he published Marcion's gospel in 2015 and named it the oldest gospel. So he did a 180% turn just through sifting through the material and through discovering that the suggestion I made 5 years earlier was correct. And so if you place now the canonical writings into the later second century, where I think they should belong to, let's say middle of the second century in the early version, and then the canonical collection in the times of Irenaeus, then of course this material has a different standing and less giving us an insight into the black box of the first century. So that was the level of understanding that I had when I was publishing Resetting.
That's really helpful. And connecting it back to your book on Jesus' resurrection is I know really helpful for me. I had made connections back with the 2019 book, but I hadn't gone back that far to see how this has been a very long-standing project for you. So. Well, thank you so much, Marcus, for taking the time to talk about your book. Before we go, I wonder, you've talked about this project and some of its past connections. Can I ask, what are you working on now? What's coming up in the future?
Yeah, I've just submitted a huge manuscript with the reconstruction of the 10-letter collection of Paul from the hands of Marcion. So it is the... we know of two collections of Pauline letters in the second century. The one is, which is being part of the New Testament, the canonical New Testament, and we know, and that's a 14-letter collection, and we know of a 10-letter collection that is being credited to Marcion, whether he just used it, as some people believe, or whether he put it together himself. That's one of the crucial questions. But what is quite clear, we have in those 10 letters, the letters which then end up also in the 14-letter collection of the canonical New Testament in a slightly different version. And now it's interesting. So that's the project. I have done the first Greek reconstruction of these 10 letters from all the evidence that we have, and have written a long introduction which explains how I came about with this type of reconstruction, and then the content, I mean, pretty much the material content about manuscripts, evidence, and so forth. And just prima vista, it is to see that the difference between the two collections is that the 14-letter collections has four more letters. And interestingly, the four letters which the canonical New Testament collection has more than the 10 is the pastoral letters and Hebrews. So precisely those letters which in modern scholarship, with a vast majority of scholars, are seen as pseudonymous letters, non-Pauline letters, letters from people who emulate Paul and credit the letters, nevertheless, to Paul, at least the passports. Hebrews written some kind of Pauline style with all differences already in early Christian history have been seen. But yet part of the Pauline letter collection in the canonical writing. Now, when Prima Vista one asks, if the 14 letter collection has as its specificity, in contrast to the 10 letter collections, four pseudonymous letters, how reliable we think is the canonical collection of Paul if it differs just by having pseudonymous additions? So if we now look and compare the texts of the 10 letters as they are in the 10 letter collection of Marcion and compare it to the 10 letter collection of the canonical text, if the canonical collection is already heavily pseudonymized, what about the additional texts, and there are mostly additional texts, that the 14-letter collection has within the 10 letters, in contrast to the 10 letters as we have them in the Marcionite collection? Would that not be also rather a pseudonymized part and elements which have been added, just as the four letters have been added to the 10 letters? And in fact, if you then compare, what are the chapters which are different? Well, the 10 letters as we have them in the 14-letter collection, the 10 letters have additional chapters like Romans 15, 16, which are missing in the other collection. We have in 2 Corinthians, the entire chapters from 8 onwards, where Paul is talking about the collection for Jerusalem. And we have chapter 13 of Romans 1 to 7 about the subjugation to the Roman state, and a few more of these elements. And it becomes so fascinating that all these chapters, which are missing in the Marcionite collection of 10 letters, are interrelated with pseudonymous writings which are only part and parcel of the canonical New Testament, namely the Catholic letters, particularly 1 Peter, 2 Peter, but also the book of Acts. So the collection for Jerusalem, which never appears in Marcion's 10-letter collection, is core and is reported about in the Acts of the Apostles. And you will find it then in Romans 15, 16, and in 2 Corinthians 8 following. Then you have people who are central in Acts and in the pastoral letters, which suddenly appear in Paul's letters, like Timothy. Timothy never appears in the 10-letter collection of Marcion, yet he appears in the additional letters, 1 Timothy, 2 Timothy, in the pastoral letters. He appears as a central core co-worker of Paul in Acts. And so he appears in the 10 letters of the 14-letter collection in the New Testament. So what I'm trying to show in this reconstruction is that presumably the 10-letter collection of Marcion brings us closer to a Pauline basis than we would have it in the canonical collection, which seems to be a drastic rewriting of all letters plus the additional letters for the purpose of the canonical New Testament. And that allows me then to dig deeper through the 10-letter collection as we have it in Marcion to see whether we find elements which might give us an insight into our black box of the first century. So that's what I've just submitted.
That sounds really fascinating. We'll have to maybe have you back on and talk more about that when that comes out. So,
right.
Oh, well, thank you. Thank you so much. We've been talking today with Marcus Vincent about his new book, Resetting the Origins of Christianity, A New Theory of Sources and Beginnings. The book was published by Cambridge University Press and is available wherever books are sold. Marcus, thank you very much for sharing your research with us.
And Jonathan, thank you so much also for today and for your research work, which I highly appreciate. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much. Thanks, everyone. We'll see you later.